Things are going to start happening to me now.
You've done all the reading. You're a scholar. You're a professor. You've done all the reading. You've done the intellectual heavy lifting.
More or less, he shouldn't die.
You wouldn't know a fact if it begged you all night long.
Want to, like, give the wrong impression, because I am very high.
F***ing right up behind him with a hatchet. Smash, smash, smash.
Yeah. Care. I'm a libertarian. What I'm getting is,
did you vote for Joe Jorgensen or Trump?
Who?
Joe Jorgensen. That was the perfect answer. Thank you.
And welcome, everybody, to the Libertarian Podcast Review. This is Tyler Yonke. And we are going, just the intro. I'm wearing a tie. I've got even slacks on. I had a suit on today, and I thought there's no better way. I got to present myself as an attorney, especially right now, because we are doing part two that I did with Pete, but it's part three of my own series. This is from episode 961 from Pete Quinones' show, examining the Leo Frank trial. The Trial and Appeals, Part 2 with Tyler Yonke, Esquire. And he puts that in there. That's really nice of you. You don't have to call me Esquire. Call me Doctor. I'm a Juris Doctorate. I've got my Juris Doctorate. Please call me Doctor, like Jill Biden Doctor. So I thought I'd get a quick intro into what this one is about. We do the trial itself. We go over the appeals. And it, pretty much the episode speaks for itself. Are there some things I didn't quite get to and I could dive in deeper? Sure. Maybe I'll come up with some of those because you'll hear about them later. And by the way, I have a Substack, Tyler Yonke. TylerYonke.substack.com. And that's, this one will be the Leo Frank trial and the ADL. And I've got all the links, all the research and links to the stuff I've done in there. And it's a treasure trove. So it's a good place to start. And then you could just walk your way through any kind of hole you want, rabbit or other. So that's some of the best stuff you've got. So this one we're doing, once again, the trial and the appeals. We talk about all this stuff over. I thought we'd talk about some of the appeal stuff. You know, I've done it all. I think there's plenty enough to go in here. And for that, we're just going to say, without any further ado, we'll play a little Cure into that. Why the Cure? I don't know. I guess some better intro music into what we have here. Leo Frank, part two with Pete Quinones. Check all his stuff out. Subscribe. And then the last one we'll do coming up is part three. He's already released it on his side, but I'll do a little intro. And that one I might want to be a little more clarification, some clarification on the Jews themselves. Specifically, kind of what this whole thing means. Why are we doing this? And we do talk about that a little bit. So without any other further ado, I don't like that comment, but without any other delays, Pete Quinones, Tyler Yonke, part two, take it away. Part three.
And a show, part two with Tyler. What's going on, Tyler? How you doing?
Good, Pete. Thanks for once again for having me. By the way, I heard your show with Bird, and I know exactly what he's saying when you do the intro and you don't know what to say, and here I am fucking it up. Thanks, Bird.
Yeah, it's always weird. It's like, hi?
Right.
You upspeak it, turn it into a question and everything.
Right, right. Yeah.
But all right, so after all the lead up to the trial that we did last time, I want to talk about the trial and the appeals today. So how did this trial get started when, just go. Yeah. Yeah. You're the lawyer.
All right. Let me start by saying there was a few slight corrections I wanted to do from last time.
Please.
And what I would tell everybody is, look, there. You had posted it out on the internet as well, on Twitter. The seminal book for this is by the Nation of Islam, The Secret Relationship Between Blacks and Jews, the Leo Frank case, Lynching of a Guilty Man, Volume 3. I think that's what it is. Yeah, there you go. Fantastic. It is so well documented. It is unbelievable. Now they throw a few good nuggets in here that, cause they come from a little bit different perspective, but I just thought they did an amazing job at it. I don't know what you're thinking of it. With that in mind, there is so much, pleadings out there. There are so many, you know, books written on it. There was, what they say, a million words of just the actual legal filings in this case. So with that in mind, there's a ton of research material. I can't remember it all. I've tried to get as best I can out to everybody. So please go and do your stuff. I hope I don't make material mistakes, but there were a few. One, you asked me last time about Newt Lee, if he was let go right away. Just make a little correction. He was actually held through the entire trial. Now he was, and I'm going to do a quick timeline here, but he was roughed up a bit. And then they decided he wasn't going to be the guy that they're going after. But they kept him basically locked up for his own protection. Okay. Another one was the ADL. I did find out that they said that the ADL technically had been started in Chicago prior to the murder, but the murder and the ADL really born out of the B'nai B'rith in Atlanta was the big seminal, you know, the ignition for all that. Other than that, that's pretty what we had. Sorry. I will say, let me start here and then we'll go into the trial. And by the way, interrupt me at any point, Pete, as you will.
Sure. Just go.
There were three, I want to talk about the three frame-ups that really happened. And then that will help us kind of walk our way through this. So you had, at one point he tries to frame, Leo Frank tries to frame Newt Lee. He's the night watchman. And how he did that was there's two notes that they found that implicated a tall, slender black man, night witch, they said, but, and we can show those notes as well. Remember that we said the time card that at one point he said it was perfectly fine. And then later on, he produced a time card that said that he had missed times to give. So he's still pushing this guy, the bloody shirt. His men somehow had obviously planted a bloody shirt that the police weren't buying it. They allowed him to interrogate Newt by himself at one point. And then in the trial, they were even, and this is fine. You know, when you're putting your defense on for your client, you're going to try to strike a reasonable doubt anywhere you can. And they were still trying to even point the finger at Newt Lee at that time. So that's the first guy. The second guy is James Gant. He was the one that came to the factory and at 6 o'clock saw Newt Lee out there with Leo Frank. Leo kind of got shocked about this whole situation. He being Leo Frank had mentioned to his Pinkertons, his private detectives, that James Gant was friendly with Mary Fagan. That's two things. One is, hey, go and investigate him. But the other thing is he had been telling the police this whole time he never met Mary Fagan. He didn't even know her. As a matter of fact, I don't even know what her name is. So now that he says that's like an implication of guilt, but it also is trying to put the onus on James Gant. So there was that part. And then we come to James Connolly. Here is the big thing with James Connolly. He's the guy that helped Leo Frank kind of dispose of the body. He was, and once again, we've put this into great perspective, which is how the South was at that time. You do not, as a black man, have a murdered white girl in a factory that you work at and suddenly think that you're just going to not be thought of as a possible, the possible guilty party. He finds out, and this comes out when you go through the trial. There's this lady, Miss White. She shows up at the factory. She sees a Negro sitting there. She's there at around 11:30. She comes back a little later. She's there at 12:30. Leo Frank makes her leave at 1 o'clock or around 12, I'm sorry. But she had seen Connolly there. She tells James Gant, I mean, she tells Leo Frank and the Pinkertons that she saw this Negro there. Now, why would you not pin the murder on Connolly immediately? He's a black man. He's seen around there. No one likes him. And he didn't get pinned. Matter of fact, that never got relayed to the police until later. She then says, oh, yeah, I told the Pinkertons, the private detectives, but I didn't. And then I told the police. So the police found out later. But Leo Frank had heard this and he didn't push that. The only reason he's not put, and there's multiple chances he has to pin the tail on the donkey of Jim Connolly, but he doesn't do it. And you know why, Pete, is because he had been implicated him already and they had their deal going that he can't say Jim Connolly, oh yeah, he's the Negro that did this. Now go check him out. Because if you're going to go do that, Jim Connolly is going to say, well, I wrote these notes. I helped him take care of the body. So for me, that's a fascinating thing. Now, let me do this real quick. It's a bit of a timeline. We'll jump real front before we go to the trial. So the 26th, Mary Fagan is murdered. The 27th, Newt Lee is arrested under suspicion of murder. The 28th, so we're getting a Tuesday, Leo Frank is questioned. He then hires the Pinkerton Detective Agency on the 30th. So it's 26, now we're at the 30th. Suspicions of Frank are finally raised by Mary's friends. They're saying, hey, he was kind of a creepy guy. And also Newt Lee tells investigators that Frank acted nervous that day. May 1, Jim Conley, an African-American sweeper at the factory, is arrested after being found in the basement trying to rinse out a blood-stained shirt. Now, this is important. This is May 1. He's rinsing out a blood-stained shirt. It turned out to be rust. And when they find him down there, why is he doing this? Well, because everyone in the factory had said, you've got to go and we're going to start to interview. So he was trying to clean a shirt. If he had done this to this girl, he would have been out of the state already. Not a doubt in my mind. He would have hit the road. You think a black man's going to get a fair trial? He's not even going to get a trial. He's just going to get lynched and we're done and over. So at that point, you even think, okay, he's maybe arrested. Maybe Leo Frank is going to start throwing some shade his way or guilt. No, it didn't happen. May 8, Newt Lee and Leo are ordered to the coroner's jury to be held under the charge of murder. So the coroner does an investigation. He says, yes, we should push it. Coroner's inquest. Then they go to the grand jury. Now there's rumors about some notes being spread around. That's when Jim Conley starts to go, ooh, maybe this is going to go south. I don't want to be the guy. He starts hearing rumors too about a black guy being implicated. He doesn't really know it's Newt Lee and he thinks maybe it's him. So he starts to come out there. Now May 21, Hugh Dorsey announces that he's going to do indictments from the grand jury against both Newt Lee and Leo Frank. And then they'll concentrate on Frank. And then the grand jury hands down an indictment on May 23rd against Leo Frank, but not against Newt Lee. And then Conley finally comes clean. And then we'll kind of get into the trial there. So that's any questions about any of that yet?
No, sounds good. All right, keep going.
Okay, so now we got the trial started. So what's so interesting about the trial, and we talked about it a little bit. I mean, look, was she raped? I don't know. There was definitely something that happened to her sexually. By the way, I didn't mention this last time because, I don't listen to the podcast I'm on necessarily, Pete, but I had to go back and listen to it and to see what I was missing here. One aspect is, okay, Leo Frank has the girl, Mary. He's trying to diddle her. She's resisting him. He hits her. She falls and she hits her head. Now, that's not what killed her, by the way. So you think of that and you're like, okay, you know, it's not first degree murder. No. He then goes and he's like, okay, my life is trash here. I can't have this girl. You know, why'd she get hit? I was trying to, you know, get in her pants. I smacked her. That can't happen. So he strangles her to death. That, to me, is that's what pushes it over the line. And I think that's what everybody really comes to like rally around. Okay, so he was sexually molesting her. He hit her. That's fine. You have a choice not to go further with this at this point. And he takes a rope and basically garrots her to the point where when they're doing the autopsy and describing this for court, the rope was still stuck in her neck as they went through. So it was pretty intense. Okay. So a few interesting aspects of how this was going to be run. So they have two attorneys on one side, two on the other for the defense, and a bunch of people are chipping in. You've got the first day, the way that they do there in Georgia at the time was they bring everybody in and they swear all their witnesses in at the same time. So the prosecution's like, no problem, we'll swear them in. And the defense is like, nope. We want to do this at a later date. They object to it. The judge overrules them. Now, the reason for doing this was they wanted to play this game, and it was great for the prosecution to see that suddenly, you know, there's like 40 witnesses that the prosecution is going to call, and the defense has around 100 plus, and they are character witnesses. They're people that are going to be, you know, coming in from out of state. They're people of his Jewish society. They're girls from the factory, a bunch of girls from the factory. So suddenly the prosecution's like, okay. And we talked about this last time, which is character and how you get to present that to the judge. And I thought I'd kind of go here of what, see if we can find what I've written out here. For the judge, what he had done. Now, this is, if you look at the all the pleadings and the trial transcript, the judge at the very end, he then lays out what the call is, basically what did you're being charged with and how he breaks it down of what you're supposed to do to think about this. So he says it's a probable cause. Of course, we need that. There's multiple standards. And he talks about the clear and convincing evidence that we have to beyond a reasonable doubt and preponderance of the evidence. Those are kind of your different standards. And obviously we're doing beyond a reasonable doubt that you have here. It's murder. It's unlawful killing of a person in the peace of a state by a person sound in memory and discretion with malice aforethought after express or implied. And then he kind of breaks down what malice is, what the presumptions are, and the different types of evidence. Different types of evidence we're looking at here, direct and indirect, okay? Circumstantial evidence, in a sense. Circumstantial evidence is not a problem. People are always like, oh, you know, this is it's just circumstantial evidence. Yeah, but sometimes that's all you really have to get somebody, and it doesn't mean that those circumstances that all build up are still not great. Now, this wasn't a direct evidence case necessarily, but there was a lot of circumstantial evidence that put Leo Frank right in the exact position. Character. Okay, so this is what the judge says about character. He goes, good character by the defense. It's introduced by a defendant is always relevant and at issue and should be considered by the jury along with all the other evidence introduced as the facts of the case. However, if guilt is established, notwithstanding the good character, then the duty is on the jury to convict. But good character should be taken into account. If that good character creates a reasonable doubt, then they should acquit. However, the general rebuttal of those that knew him prior to the death of Mary Fagan, the state is then allowed to attack it by showing his general reputation is not good, by showing those witnesses who testified to his good character were untruly reporting. Therefore, the state can ask if those testifying, if they've heard of certain acts of misconduct, those is evidence. This is not evidence to misconduct unless they testify to it. So in other words, once you bring character into it, you can then bring bad character. And so we start out and we can walk through kind of the first week of the trial, the second week. I mean, it's 4 weeks. I'm not going to, we're going to sit here and walk through 4 weeks of testimony. Right. So I'll kind of break it down to begin with, which is you have, they bring in the mom. The prosecution does a really good thing in the first week of just kind of laying out everything, the timeline. Newt Lead testifies. Once again, remember, they had several colored men, as they dictated on the transcript, Newt Lee, Jim Connolly, and they had not really ever had the right to testify before in Georgia. The 14th Amendment was put in place specifically for that, 1866, to try to institute the fact that in all the states, they would say that people can actually testify in court, have their due process. So we have Jim Connolly and Newt comes in, testifies, does a great job. And once again, the defense is, it's such a class warfare that they put on this, Pete, which is you've got the dirty Negro here, and then you've got this wonderful Leo Frank and his good character of which, and just look at the way that the black man is done up. Matter of fact, they make a case, the defense at one point when Jim Connolly is there about the fact that he's got clean shirt on, that he's got his hair fixed and you know, he's showered, and that you're typically a dirty Negro, as they even say in court. And it's fascinating that, you know, when you come out of this, that you try to put this, the ADL then says, oh, it's so anti-Semitic, yet your racist commentary the whole time is just outlandish. Okay, so race doesn't really come into this whole thing for the most part. Jump ahead, Leo Frank's mom, there were two incidences that kind of come out. One is she's in the gallery and she yells at the the prosecutor, Hugh Dorsey, you dirty Christian dog or Gentile dog at one point. And that.
Yeah, there it goes. There it is.
But yeah, this is what's great, Pete, is the next day there wasn't a pogrom. There wasn't a mob outside. There wasn't anything like that. She just came back into court. and all was good. All right. You want me to keep going? Hammering away here?
I mean, yeah, it's just wild that it seems like there's a lot of tolerance going on.
Yeah.
Yeah. On all sides. And even saying that you turn it into a class war. That's interesting because yeah, no one would ever think that somebody of high class would come on to a young girl and possibly hurt her. I mean, there's no evidence of that anywhere in like history before that, right? None, not at all.
But this is used over and over. I mean, jump forward in a few years. Another issue I get real deep into is Whitaker Chambers, Alger Hiss, the pumpkin papers, and was Alger Hiss a communist spy? And Whitaker Chambers, he had horrible teeth. And that was the thing they were actually talking about in front of HUAC was, look at his teeth. He's a disheveled man. This is literally what they're saying. Why would I ever associate with him? Therefore, I couldn't have been handing him, papers, secret spy stuff. Anyway, that's a different thing there.
All right. So second, Mama Frank comes back into the courtroom. No one's screaming at her. No one's trying to kill her, and everything goes on. So what happens?
Yeah. So a matter of fact, in the closing, Hugh Dorsey, the prosecutor, the solicitor there, he actually makes a call to the sense of what we talked about here of the Jews in the South being part of community. And then he equates his religion to their religion and tries to basically he's propping him up. He's not saying anything ornery or bad. And that never comes into it at all. There's no race. Matter of fact, the only race that really gets brought up is once again by his mom. And then the fact that he's bringing members of his B'nai B'rith society in there to testify on his good character. Okay. The first part that you have really big issue with the prosecution is Jim Conley. He comes in there week two, the first week. It had been pretty good setting all these things up. And now he's testifying. He does multiple days. I think 16 hours, they say, of testimony. This is a dumb Negro, as they say. He can't be believed. Yet the best cross-examiners here in the state and probably in the nation at the time couldn't crack him. They couldn't get him to do anything other than just tell his story. And he was really pretty good at it. And he was somewhat entertaining. So that's perfectly fine. Now, the problem is that you've got to be able to, for him, describing, it's from the legal sense here, some of these situations, seeing Leo Frank in a compromising situation, doing these things. So there's objections at this point to him being able to even testify to this. And you'll talk about it when it goes to the appeals, which are, can you talk about someone's character? Because they're saying, hey, you can't talk about his character unless we're bringing it up. And you're going first as the prosecution. You can't even do this. But there's a pattern and a scheme that you can describe of someone is doing something like a past act, maybe another criminal activity. Once again, you can't bring their other crimes into it to say that since they did this criminal act, that therefore they would do this criminal act, this other one. But you can say that it's done in a scheme and in a way and in a plan that continually happens, that now you can use it for this case to show that it's likely that this happened as well. And that's exactly how, over the objections that they got a lot of this testimony in from Jim Conley. Now, just from my own, Pete, there's so much here and I'm trying to go back and I've even looked at some of the law that they had at the time, and it's tough. Hearsay is a big one. That's been a rule that's been through common law since the 1500s. It looked like there was a lot of hearsay being thrown around here. And I don't know if they were objecting to it or not. Some of the transcript, when you read it, I haven't found actually where it shows all sides of the conversation. So the massive document that they did for their appeal, all sides said it was good. And then everyone's used that since then. It's just the testimony. It doesn't show what the cross-examiner is saying, the attorneys, it just says all the answers. But some of that stuff has been filtered into the record so you can see it. But point is, there's a lot of hearsay being done. Okay. Week one, week two, Conley's done. The defense rests. And now the prosecution rests, the defense starts bringing in all their stuff. And they start off with just what I consider trivial stuff. They're trying to break the timeline, which is very important. You know, Leo Frank put himself in a box by saying, I never left this office. Someone saw you, came in there, and you weren't there. This girl dies, and we were able to pin it at the right time. You know, it happens right next to your office. You know, yet you don't hear anything. Mary Fagan, I had $1.20 on her. Oh, Jim Connolly probably killed her because he wanted $1.20. You know, Leo Frank had thousands of dollars in his office at the time. You know, these things don't add up. So they try to come in with, you know, like the trolley times, you know, countering with different stuff. And you had asked last time about, was Jim Connolly ever offered to change his story? No, he wasn't, because that would have been difficult. Because, I mean, they tried to kill him, actually. They tried to poison him in jail. That's actually came out. But they didn't try to actually pay him off because they figured, once again, the class situation, you've got a black man, he's not going to be believed. You know, he probably shouldn't even testify. That's their thinking at the time. But a lot of other people did, and it reminded, did take money and did try to change, you know, have stories that were not correct. It reminded me of the, was it Paul Begala or one of those guys talked about, you know, you drag a $20 bill through the trailer park, you could get any kind of story you want, talking about the Clintons and stuff like that. It's kind of what happened here with all this money going on, that you started having the defense people trying to counter some of the few words, things here and there. But the big thing was when they started to bring girls in to talk about how great Leo was at the factory, suddenly that's when the dam breaks. And then all hell breaks loose. So the rebuttal that comes from the state, they're able to start getting rebuttal witnesses. And then they start to unload this, you know, girls saying, oh, yeah, he's coming into our dressing room. Oh, yeah, he touched me. They're also able to bring in this. There was this another guy, Dalton. I'm sorry. And he was one that Jim Connolly said that, oh, yeah, he used to come here and bring girls in with him. And Leo would let him hang around. So that guy comes and testifies saying, yeah, I did that. The girl that he was there with, one of them was like, yeah, that happened. Another one's like, no, and no, she's married. She's going to perjure herself. She's going to protect her relationship. And walk all the way through this. There's a lot of objections to these kind of, you know, witness testimony. But in the end, they're done and over in 2 weeks. Now, there's, if you read the closing arguments, they had both had two attorneys. So it's actually pretty fascinating. These guys were well done. But before they do that, there's one other thing that happens, which is it seems like a huge mistake to me. Now, the South, you know, honor society that you have, which would be, okay, Leo Frank should go up there, testify, cross-examination, show he's a man, say he didn't do it. And, you know, as a man in the South, we'll either believe him or we don't. But that's how you do it. Well, you had three options at the time. One, just like now, don't testify, take the fifth. Two, testify and get cross-examined. But they had a nice little thing where he could make a statement, unsworn, and not have the option to be cross-examined. So Leo Frank, yeah, it's a little crazy. So Leo Frank decides that he's going to do this. He's been preparing for this. So he gets up there, and almost to all accounts, you have pro-Frank, you have anti-Frank. Everybody says it was a rambling, mind-numbing experience. He spent hours talking about and showing how he goes through, because he did all the accounting for the NPC, showing how he did his accounting that day. He walked everyone through the math, basically to indicate, if I'm going to have done this, I didn't have enough time. I was too busy doing this calculations. Anyway, I don't know what the point, because it bored everyone to death. But then he says one aspect, which is he wants to start talking about this. And he says, I may have unconsciously used the restroom that day around between the 12:30. That to me, I mean, you know, there's people, there's like three or four instances where he basically claims it or admitted to doing it. I should go back to one of those, which is his in-laws. He lived with his in-laws, the Seeligs, and they had some servants. The night of the murder, one of the servants there, she told her husband that she was in the room. Leo Frank comes in. He's drunk. It's later in the evening. And he said, I killed a girl. Give me my gun. I'm going to kill myself. And that's what he's saying to his wife. And he didn't do it. So this lady, her husband's like, oh, shit, this guy's a creep. Tells the cops. They come and get her. She goes in there. She has counsel with her the whole time. and she gives an affidavit that he had said that. Now, the prosecution can't introduce this affidavit. They didn't even bring her up to testify because she had then tried to recant this. So she goes in the stand and she's talking about some other things. And so then which is dumb to bring her in, I think, from the defense. But the prosecution then says to push back against what she's just claimed, they show the affidavit. And now they have testimony all around that. So that's one aspect that actually on the appeals they bring up. So he's admitted to someone there. There was another admittance that they think it was Newt Lee when he was in the interrogating him, when he said, "We're both going to burn for this." And then obviously in court saying, "I may have gone down to the bathroom myself." So the jury steps out. They take 2 hours. They come back in. Just rewind a bit on the grand jury. There were 5 Jews, by the way, on the grand jury that indicted him. 2 of them happened to be members of his B'nai B'rith. I don't think there were any Jews on this jury, but they said he was guilty within 2 hours. There's one aspect that's important here, which is the judge.
Wait a minute. Okay, hold on. You said that there were five Jews on the jury grand jury that indicted him.
Yes.
But you don't think there were any Jews? There's no evidence of Jews being on the jury that convicted
him. I have not heard any positive statements that there were. Yeah. So, nothing there. 2 hours come out. Now, there was due process is basically I need to have my chance to be served. Jurisdiction has to have over me. I get a chance to have my day in court. And all the little procedural aspects that go along with that. And one of the things that they said here in criminal courts in Georgia is that he had the right to be present at every aspect of his trial. Now, the judge was concerned that whatever the outcome of the trial, this activity, although there had never been any outbreaks in the court, there really had been nothing outside the court. I think I told you I saw this movie that was done in the 80s. And I'm trying to remember some of the actors in there, but there's a bunch of famous actors. Go back and watch it. It's pro Frank scenario. And what they do in there, which is I can't find anywhere in history historically to prove that this is the case. During the trial, a bunch of Christians are standing right outside the window and they're singing like some Christian hymn. And that's supposed to be showing that, you know, hey, we're Christians. We are going to get you, you dirty Jew. That never happened. That's nothing like that happened. But the judge is concerned that if Leo Frank's out there when the jury's read, something might happen. So Leo Rosser, his attorney, the defense attorney, and with Hugh Dorsey, the prosecutor, they come to an agreement that they will waive his right to be there. Now, Dorsey's explicit, like, you can't use this against us. You're going to waive this. You can't use this against us. They're like, yeah, perfectly fine. The jury comes out, says guilty. They poll the jury. Every single one of you tell us about it. They all say guilty, guilty, guilty. And we're done and over. And then he's sentenced to death in a few days or a few weeks. But we can, any questions about the trial? That's how we have that.
Right. Well, no, that sounds good. There's numerous appeals. So I guess, is that where we're going to go now? Get into the appeals?
Yeah, if you want to. I think there's.
Yep, let's do that. I think that's important because a lot of people are like, oh, you know, it's of course a Georgia jury is going to convict this dirty Jew, you know, of the murder. But no, there was plenty of appeals. So
13, I believe, all in all.
Hit the highlights.
Yeah. So, yeah. And by the way, the best thing about this, that, you know, it's the time era that we're in. All this has been documented. So we have all this information, which is a great thing for everyone to go through, but it's not so good for the ADL. They really want to go through this and they want to go through the facts of all this. And by the way, if you go back and read at the time, even pro Frank, you know, articles and everything, there's things that are just vastly missing, which is anti-Semitism. It's just not at all in the picture at the time. And I think that's, to me, the one of the frustrating things you get from this, which is, hey, Tyler, you know, someone posted on Twitter, oh, big balls to do this episode. And I go, I don't know about that. I mean, we're just breaking down the case and you're going to get yelled at for what you come out with. because your little team isn't seen in a good light. That's no way to go through it. Anyway, that's my opinion there, Pete.
Yeah, I mean, if someone on my team murders a 13-year-old girl, I'm not standing up for them.
No. Yeah. No. Yeah. I mean,
They're not on my team anymore.
Right. Okay. So let's walk. I'll walk through quickly just kind of the dates of all the different motions that happened, just so we could kind of see them, and then we'll break through just some highlights of the main issues that happened. So he was sentenced to death on the 26th of August. He immediately files a new motion for a new trial. And it goes through Judge Roan. So it's got to look, and we'll talk about this real quick, which is when you file an appeal, it's not like, I didn't like that ruling, so I need someone else to, you know, tell them that they were wrong. No, it's, you have to say for reasons of objections that were overruled or the misapplication of law, or that you was just so egregious in the outcome that it did not warrant the verdict that was there. So it's pretty specific about what you have to do. He files a motion immediately. It goes to Judge Roan, who had been the judge in the Superior Court that had just done the trial. He denies it, and then they start pushing that thing up there. I just thought it was interesting. So let me see. Yeah, this is one. In this state, a defendant charged with a crime and tried by a jury is given the right by motion for a new trial to have it reviewed, a verdict and judgment rendered against him, and to have it set aside if set aside for an illegality or irregularity amounting to harmful error in the trial, including such grounds as the reception of a verdict in his absence. But where such motion is made, it should include all proper grounds which were at the time known to the defendant or his counsel, or which by reasonable diligence could have been discovered. And that is really important, and that kind of becomes the linchpin, which is he doesn't bring up in his first, and it's 103 different grounds for dismissal of a new trial that he wants. He does a writ on the error and just keeps going through with these, but he doesn't on this first attempt bring up the fact that he was not in the courtroom. Okay, now his attorneys had said we're waiving it, we're not, but now it's different attorneys that are working all the appeals for him, and they don't bring that up in his first motion. It comes back to somewhat bite him. So he gets those denied, and he keeps going through. He files another one. And you've got the multiple courts here. So the 13 isn't quite 13. It's like goes to the first one and then he appeals to the next one or he amends it. He then comes back. The motion for a new trial is denied. So then he does what's called a writ of errors. Here's all these errors that were supposed to have been corrected and that weren't, all these objections. Was he able to use the character? Well, they overruled him on all those. Can he, you know, the plan and the scheme, can you do that? These other issues of, you've had these two doctors that had an outside issue with each other. Was that a problem? You know, nothing. And it has to be relevant. It has to be material. So they can be minor errors. Oh, maybe that shouldn't happen. But is that really an error that's going to cause this whole trial to be upended? And it continually gets denied. Then he starts doing, and this is all through 1914, back in November. He then goes up and he puts this writ of error to the Supreme Court of the United States through the district court. They deny him. Then he comes back and his last ditch effort is for habeas corpus. So this is, you file it against the jailer, Magnum was his name. And you file it for, like, look, I'm illegally imprisoned for something. You didn't even have jurisdiction to do this. It should be letting me free based on the fact that he due process, 14th Amendment now. Mob rule. The mob was so enveloped that, you know, singing Christian songs outside my window that I had no choice, but I didn't get due process. So Supreme Court of Georgia turns him down, and that one goes finally gets accepted, goes up to the Supreme Court. And to me, that one's somewhat fascinating. One, they reject him on the lower courts for saying, if you didn't bring this issue up the first time, you've lost it. You've waived it. Matter of fact, it says here that you're supposed to bring all known issues. You lost your chance for doing a new trial. You missed it there. You should have brought this fact up that you were not in the courtroom at the time. Now, with that said, the 14th Amendment, as we talk about, it's at the time sub I don't know how well you are on the 14th or our listeners here, but
I'm pretty good with the 14th.
Okay. Yeah. So, you know, 14th Amendment, which the NOI Nation of Inland does take into account, which is what was the purpose of this in the first place? It was really to help black men be able to have the right to vote. That was one of them. And now you're trying to use it against him, basically, for this guy that's trying to string up a black man. You know, Nation of Islam book didn't like that. I don't know if that's really a great correlation. But what you had here, all the cases at this time, there wasn't substantive due process. It was just procedural due process, if that could even be applied at all. And they take it up the Supreme Court and they say, with this in mind, is this mob so unruly that we couldn't have given you due process? The interesting part about that one, Pete, is that there's this guy, William Burns. I think maybe you've heard about him. He was a private investigator that took hundreds of thousands of dollars from a lot of lobbyists and people in the North to go through and find the real killer. Now, what he ended up doing was he did drag the dollar bill through the trailer park. He got a bunch of people to sign affidavits, fake affidavits. I mean, there was a bunch of lies. He just got obliterated himself in the South because Dorsey, the solicitor, said, we're not going to have this. So they went after a lot of, he's like, here's an affidavit saying that this guy on the jury was making comments, you know, about kill the Jews. Well, anyway, a lot of this stuff was filed in their writ of error. Now, the Supreme Court actually mentions that in their order, which is, it's interesting that you have a lot of, you know, affidavits pointing the finger elsewhere, but you didn't include them with your Supreme Court brief. So they decided, okay, this stuff is such bullshit, I can't actually include it in there. Anyway, there were two dissenters on the Supreme Court. They do knock him down. They say that the mob wasn't to the point that it was a problem. As far as due process goes, it's procedural, which is we're only as the feds here with the 14th Amendment, we're enforcing due process as what the state would be, privileges and immunities of the state, not what we think due process is from the Fed. So the Fifth Amendment. So your due process, whatever it was there, you had a waiver, you're good. We're fine. We're not going to say that it's any issue. We're not going to overrule you. Interesting. Oliver Wendell Holmes, famous Supreme Court justice who made that stupid line, fire in a crowded theater. He did dissent. He didn't talk anything about the 14th Amendment. He just said, look, the crowd seemed to be unruly, and therefore you should have had a better chance at this. The great thing, though, Pete, all the filings, it's not like any of these rulings were short-sighted. They took a lot of time. There's a lot of writing in there. And I think personally, going through all the stuff, that they came out with the right ruling. The great thing about this is that, you know, this 4-day or 4-week trial, longest one that they had, all this pleadings, all these appeals that they have, they couldn't find any error strong enough to give them a new trial. Even the ones that did dissent, because they weren't all, you know, I think there was a 7-2 on the Supreme Court, the Georgia Supreme Court, not everyone was unanimous on all of those. Even the dissents, though, they're always like, maybe he could give this to him, but they weren't definitive, forthright in their taking. So the Supreme Court says overrules him, and he's sentenced to death. And then we have a Governor Slayton issue going on.
I'm wondering if we want to sort of cut it there to save for part three, or. Do you think we can get into anything else and be coherent in part three?
we could cut it if you want. Let me ask you that. Do you have any questions about any of these things?
Well, I mean, admittedly, what I know of court law is I used to read a lot of decisions, but mostly from like Supreme Court decisions. Mm-hmm. I was obsessed with Ashwander for a long time. Mm. I thought that was like a lot of the decisions around the New Deal, because mm-hmm. I thought that was like the turn of everything.
Yeah.
It's when the whole country just basically went up in smoke. But yeah, it doesn't seem to me like, I mean, well, in the trial itself, is it just that they look and they're like, okay, he is the only one who had opportunity to do it. And combined with the fact that Conley, I guess on the stand, is basically telling him about the money, telling him about is that what does it?
I think it's the full breadth of everything, the whole story, which is Conley. They find him to be believable, although it's over and over and over. They even had the one point they grouped about 10 witnesses, and they just said they all testified that Jim Conley as a Negro couldn't be believed under oath. So they really went hard at that. But yes, he testified. I think he was believable. The fact that Leo Frank's story had changed, and then the fact that they were able to bring out in the trial a lot of these little things where he was trying, it was obvious he was trying to frame either Newt Lee or this James Gant, and he never took the opportunity to do the same to Jim Connolly. I think that was so powerful, that there was this Miss White who saw him in the factory, that he's there a week later, still hanging around. It blows everyone's mind that this black man would not just take off if he had actually done that. So with that, and the fact that because I think just the facts themselves dealt with this. Enough girls came up and said, yeah, he was creepy. He was trying to touch me. He was looking through the peephole. He had been doing these exact things that Leo Frank or Jim Conley says he was going to do. And then just there's a gruesome murder, possible rape going involved there.
Yeah. Do you think the Supreme Court, like Thomas says that Oliver Wendell Holmes gets a bad rap on a lot of things. Do you think that was just his not realizing that really anti-Semitism had anything to do with this trial? That was Holmes just like a knee-jerk reaction, or was it just his contrarian nature?
It very well may have been. Look, as far as Oliver Wendell Holmes, yeah, I brought up the fire in the crowded theater, which is bad, but he's not bad on all of his decisions. So, you know, it's kind of a mixed bag. And by the way, I think a lot of judicial temperament, and when you look back on it, has to deal with kind of where you are now. And, you know, as an example, I look back through all the different story, as a matter of fact, Justice Story, I think he's a piece of shit, you know, kind of the things. It depends on where your personal view is and how you see these people. Even him, though, he was reserved on a lot of this stuff. And he just said, look, it seems to be the mob trial. The problem, though, and this is what's amazing, is, you know, I think Brandeis was the first Jewish member of the Supreme Court. He wasn't coming on there yet. That was still to be coming on a few years. I think it was 1917, I want to say. So I could be wrong. Check me out on that. But he definitely wasn't on at this point. That the overwhelming feeling of the North and all the news, you couldn't avoid this case. So I'm sure the Supreme Court justices had read stuff. And the New York Times was pumping out what they say. There was more words written about Jim Conley in the New York Times than about W.D. Du Bois. So, you know, that's extreme for even the New York Times at the time. So you can't help but think that they had been somewhat influenced, because you now had 2 years from the time of the actual guilty to when the Supreme Court's going and doing this, for all the papers to really, really ramp up the anti-Semitic trope that they were pushing out.
All right, well, then I guess we'll wrap it up there. And next time obviously the lynching, but also we can start getting into the press and just exactly how much the press and how much from the North, how much came from the North. Like you said, all the words were written, but also talk about the governor who looks like he went on a world tour after...
I think he was promised a lot.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. And and one thing that a mistake that I made, and I didn't know until recently, was that I guess we'll talk about this next, is that he didn't commute his sentence. He commuted his death sentence.
Yes, you're right. He even had some skepticism as to what he was committed it to life in prison, which still means, OK, I mean, that, you know, you might have the death sentence, but you at least have life in prison. So yeah, I agree. Yeah.
Well, we can also on the next one talk about what could, like, I don't, you know, trying to get into the mind of somebody who's in a lynch mob is could be damaging to one's soul, but the what the idea may have been around somebody who has now a life sentence and is alive, and is there, you know, there is still a chance of a you could have a presidential commutation, something like that. So, you know, I know that after, I guess after you go to the Supreme Court, you can't, you can't get a pardon.
Well, you
the president.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the president could only has even now, I mean, you know, even the way we're mixing things in, the president can only pardon federal crimes. So, you know, this crime, you know, he was screwed in that sense.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Well, good. All right. What, I think last time you said, if anybody wants to find any find your work, at go to your Twitter account, at Tyler Yonke.
That's correct. Yeah, thanks, Pete.
Cool. All right, man. Well, until the next time, can't wait.
Yep.
Take care.
Okay.
But she's back.
Chick-fil-A is completely overrated. It's not that good. I prefer Zaxby's. I prefer Popeye's.
It's a tough man to make a tender forecast, Nick. I guess that's me. Keep fucking that chicken.
Should I vote for Dick Cheney on the Libertarian Party? Do I have an obligation to vote for Dick Cheney?
I would say so.
Yes.
Did it work for those people?
No, it never does. I mean, these people somehow delude themselves into thinking it might, but it might work for us.
That one dude was like, not a podcast. I can't find it anywhere. I don't have video.
Oh, yeah, Peter Zanke. Yeah,
I blocked him.
I'll do it. If he unblocks me, I'll...
He'll buy your shirt if you unblock Bert.
He's a wigger.
Yeah, nothing cooler than so a 49-year-old wigger. Like, yeah,
I just started live streaming. Cut me some slack. I'm pretty high-tech for a boomer. But anyways...
Boomer.